You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is Adam Smith, the longtime political editor at the Tampa Bay Times and now political consultant with Mercury Public Advisors. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So I want to know what makes a politician. They come onto the scene. What are the growth tracks that lead people to become a politician?
You know, I'm actually not as cynical as a lot of people. I think for the vast majority, it's idealism and genuinely trying to make the world or their community a little bit better place. I think also for the vast majority, it's ego, because clearly you got to have an ego to step up and think you're the one that can lead the country. But yeah, I think most of them start out with good intentions. Sometimes if you stay a while, you get sort of so fawned over, it can change your priorities and perceptions.
Hmm. And a lot of these guys and women, are they business people that sort of come to the end of their interest in business and find they can connect with what they're really after in life by going into politics? Or are they issue driven? There's usually one issue that will sort of catapult them into it.
You know, unfortunately, the vast majority are not necessarily representative of most of us because they have high income. You have to be fairly wealthy to run for some of these offices. If you're running for Congress, that oftentimes means you have to have two residences, and that's not cheap in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get a decent salary of more than $100,000, but you got a family and two residences, and that doesn't necessarily go that far. You run for your local city council job. That's generally supposed to be a part-time job, but it's a lot more than that. It's tough to do that. Legislature, you know, it meets just a few months, but really you're constantly working. So this is a business in most cases where you got to be very comfortable financially.
And one of the other disconnects that I think would be natural in, we'll call them high-functioning, successful business people, is then this sort of slam of necessity to connect with, you know, the weirdest and poorest and different looking and all these different people that you are responsible for now, and they're coming at you from all directions.
You know, yes and no, because the way these districts are drawn these days, they're so drawn to help the incumbent or a particular party win. So if I'm Joe Schmo running for the legislature in, well, let's say East Pasco County, you know, your district is probably going to, actually, that's not a good example because that's one of the few swing areas, but most of these areas are not swing areas and you're targeting very homogeneous population, consistently conservative or, you know, fiscally conservative, socially conservative in some cases. And likewise, if you're a Democrat, you're often packed into an overwhelmingly Democratic district.
So essentially just a bunch of little echo chambers laying next to each other.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons you're going to see a ballot initiative in Florida where people who are not registered to either party may be able to vote in both primaries. That way, arguably, and I believe the best representation are the people that have to answer to the broadest audience. You know, that's where you have compromise. That's where you have to work together with both sides. Instead of just constantly looking over your shoulder, if you're a Republican for a primary challenge from the far right, and if you're a Democrat, a primary challenge from the far left, that just excludes the middle, the vast middle in so many cases.
So you said you weren't cynical about a lot of the initial intentions of the politicians. What's your take on the objectivity of the general population when it comes to the ones that are coming out and being politically active?
Well, again, it's kind of the problem with the way we have gotten so partisan. And that includes the media as well, that people just, you know, one of the reasons the Times started PolitiFact was even before there was all these talk of alternative facts, and we had a president that pretty routinely said demonstrably, objectively false statements, that people just view things in their own little window. So you watch Fox News, you have a very, very different perception of what's happening in the world than if you're watching MSNBC or CNN.
And a lot of this is probably comes out of the marketing world, where now if you want people to do a certain thing and feel a certain way, I mean, I look at issues like the border and you think of all the education issues, poverty, starvation, a million issues that people could be fervently on one side or the other of, and it's this border, that's because of marketing and effective marketing.
That's because of marketing, and that's really largely because of media, I think. You know, you have a lot of parts of Florida where there is virtually no problem with illegal immigration.
Right.
And those areas where there is significant illegal immigration tend to be agricultural areas where many people are not that concerned about it because they need those workers. But, you know, you go down to Sarasota County, you know, generally has always been a moderate Republican county. That was literally the number one issue driving Republican voters, especially primary voters, because of what they see on the media.
How do we reconcile that then? If it's not really in the places where it's really not a problem, people are up in arms about it, and the people were places where it may be by actual quantity of illegal immigrants showing up, they're okay with it because they want them there. So then how do you reconcile this idea that the media is pushing this issue?
Our republic was not founded to constantly respond to every cry that the general population makes. That's why we have a U.S. Senate that's supposed to be, you know, a little bit more broad thinking. But that's just not the world we live in now. Everybody's so concerned about a primary,
right?
And they're terrified of that, especially Republicans. They're terrified of that base. And any reporter, especially those in Washington, talks to senators and U.S. House members every day that are often disgusted and will say off the record how disgusted they are about some of the divisive rhetoric that comes out, but they won't say it on the record because they're terrified.
I mean, it's worth digging into. So if it's not an issue that's supported by people living in that space, you know, it's either, like you said, just media, then am I led then to believe that the journalists that are putting stuff out on this feel like they have to, and it's almost just like it becomes a fad, and if you're not writing about it, and the next person is, they're going to get the readers, and so they have to write about it, and it just sort of snowballs into an issue that's not actually affecting people on a day-to-day basis other than in their heads?
Yeah, and I shouldn't say there are areas where people just don't care about it. In some of those agricultural areas, the businesses certainly don't care about it. And broadly speaking, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is very supportive of immigration. They're not going to be supportive of illegal immigration. But, you know, if the president of the United States is saying this is a number one, you know, top priority, virtually like a war facing the country, that's a story. If every Republican primary is being waged on who's softer on illegal immigrants, that's a story. Hmm. But, you know, I spent a fair amount of time in the last election cycle going to various events, and especially in the Republican primary, you would have thought that sanctuary cities was just a crisis afflicting every community in Florida. There are no sanctuary cities.
And that brings me back to the marketing aspect of it, really. It just seems to be so powerful how much of a frenzy that a concerted effort can whip up and create this, you know, fear. And then this, you know, essentially creates this self-supporting cycle of the fear becomes the news, and the news has to report on the fear, and then off we go.
Yeah. And I think that's not entirely new. I'm not meaning to pick on the right, because I think that the left certainly exploits things all the time. But, you know, you go back to the Red Scare and the Nixon policy on civil rights to scare everybody. That's not new to mobilize voters through fear and anger. It's a very effective tool.
And we're just getting better and better at it.
Yeah.
Every year. Let's talk about the news business. You know, a long time at the Times, obviously they've had their trials and tribulations. So where do you see the news business going? Where do you see the large print-based, you know, major newspapers in towns going?
Nobody has quite figured out the business model here. The Times has been for a long time more fortunate than most because we have this unique structure where we're owned by a nonprofit, and there wasn't intense pressure on us to be giving giant returns to shareholders. But, you know, when so many of these national advertising deals dry up, it's very tough. So I think you're going to be seeing probably higher subscription rates. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very costly. And so no longer are you going to have newspapers trying to, you know, cover a vast, vast geography in terms of circulation. It's just not cost effective. It's going to be more expensive to subscribe to a newspaper. I think you're seeing shorter newspapers, and you're going to see a lot more reliance on local advertising. And eventually, it's happening too slowly for most, but online advertising, those rates are going to have to go up to sustain what we have. And likewise, you know, paywalls. The Times has now got a paywall.
Yep.
We can't keep giving away. I say we because I'm so used to being there. One can't keep giving away a product that's very expensive to produce.
And I had a thought, you know, looking around at some of the other institutions, you know, theoretically, one person can report and put out their own publication or whatever. And you see small news outlets springing up all the time. But there's a certain critical mass you need to achieve to have the support and to be able to go on into something for a month or 2 months and have the lawyers and the editors and then also the reach and everything. And I kind of started to think about art and the symphony and other institutions in our society that if you're going to have a symphony, you need to have a symphony hall. You need to have 100 musicians. They need to be able to practice. But really nowhere is that supported by ticket sales. And same goes with the Dali and art museums, right? You have to have these big buildings to put this beautiful art in to create the experience. And so we've come to a place where wealthy people support it because they believe it benefits the common good. And I wonder if journalism might not go that same way, where it's a thing that benefits the common good that you need to have a certain critical mass to, but that maybe just simply can't support itself as a business model.
Well, I'm optimistic that eventually the business model will stabilize and it'll work. But there's no question that has been the model. I mean, the Washington Post was in at least as much financial trouble as the Times, probably worse, but then Jeff Bezos stepped in. And now they've got a vast, ever-growing staff doing phenomenal journalism. That's the case in Boston, in Philadelphia, and Las Vegas, where you've got wealthy, wealthy philanthropists subsidizing these outlets. I mean, then the danger is when you have people that have a clear agenda and aren't really hands-off. And then what really worries me, more than the biggest markets, are what's happening to the regional papers. Because, you know, all across the country, you're seeing these news deserts where, you know, a decent-sized market is no longer sustaining a vibrant local paper. So nobody's covering those county commission meetings. Nobody's covering those water districts and the shenanigans that can go on that are taking in a lot of taxpayer money. That's the foundation of democracy. One of the things our republic was built on is a free press, a vibrant free press that can inform people so they know what the right decisions to make.
Right. So you recently flipped to the other side of that equation. You went from being on the coverage of the candidate to sort of being next to the candidate. So can you talk about that journey for you?
Yeah, I'm doing much more than candidates. I'm doing a lot of business help too. I'm mostly focusing on communications and helping get a sort of a message and a strategy out for communicating. But yeah, it's eye-opening. You see a lot of, just as some of the reporters don't quite understand how a campaign works, there's a lot of misunderstanding about how a journalist works, a lot of misunderstanding.
Right.
You know, what is going to generate media interest sometimes is not quite understood. How the editorial board works versus how the straight newsroom works, they really don't overlap. Everybody has a hard time understanding that, but it's just true.
I'm assuming you had a lot of latitude in what you wrote about. So what was the process for, you know, envisioning a story and then pushing it out? What was your decision criteria? What did you look for? What did you feel like your unique take on things was?
You know, I just was interested in what was interesting to me and what I thought was important for people to know. You know, sometimes it's just covering an event. If Donald Trump comes to town, we're going to cover it. And ideally, I think a local outlet should cover it in a way, you know, if we're covering the U.S. Senate, you know, with our Washington reporters, we don't want to be covering the exact same thing that we can get from the Associated Press or from the New York Times. We should have a more localized take on it or a distinctive take on it. But yeah, if I'm covering any election, I think generally the Times wants to own the coverage of a statewide race. I think that's the job of the political editor at the Times, which has always been a very, very high profile position. But at the same time, not get bogged down in the total minutiae that only insiders care about.
Right. And how conscious were you of your own voice? Did you feel like people had an expectation for your perspective? I mean, I'm assuming the answer to being able to deliver that all the time is simply being authentic all the time. But, you know, I was a big fan of Hunter S. Thompson, who came out a certain way and ended up being trapped by that. And I wonder how often that happens to people who are widely read.
Yeah, I mean, Hunter S. Thompson had the luxury or the box that he came from a very distinctive left point of view.
Right.
If you're at the Tampa Bay Times, you can't antagonize 50% of the readers. And, you know, I don't happen to come from a very particularly left or right point of view anyway. But yeah, I think you want to write distinctively. I was always encouraged to use my voice. At the same time, I think there's just way too much punditry out there. So I did my share of punditry. I usually tried to make it blended in with actual reporting, but just to blather on about what you think about this or that, or what's good and what's bad, I don't think is that valuable. If you spend any time watching cable TV, you know, it can be like root canal after a while. Everybody blathering about their opinions and saying the same thing over and over.
Yeah, I agree. Now that you're outside of the Times, had a chance to breathe and kind of, you know, get some fresh air in your lungs, looking back at the Times, what do you think, if you could change a couple of things there, or even go back in time and change a couple of things, what would you say those would be?
Well, yeah, hindsight's 2020, so a lot of it would be on the business side, and it's easy for me to second guess, and I'm not really second guessing because hindsight's 2020, but clearly right before the economy tanked, we and most other newspapers were spending significantly more than we should have been.
Right.
And that made it tougher. We, the Times, had a particularly challenging situation because we had a market with two major newspapers. At one time, we were always number one and number two newspapers in the state. And there are very few, really almost no markets, except maybe New York City. And even then, that's a suspect, that can sustain two newspapers anymore. So, you know, sadly, one of us was going to die, and that made it more challenging. And, you know, for us to compete, we very much spent a lot of money to expand into Hillsborough and to make sure we were overwhelmingly the dominant newspaper when there were ultimately going to only be one.
So if the Tribune would have gone away quicker by a year or two or three, then perhaps the Times would have gone on a different trajectory. You're saying that in battling them.
Yeah. You know, I'm not wishing that they had.
Just, yeah.
In a way I am, because I think if the Tribune had gone under quicker, our financial footing would have been a lot stronger going into these really tough times, and we would have been able to withstand it because we hadn't been spending so much money on things like, you know, virtually giving away the paper in lots of parts of Hillsborough, and maybe we would have done the naming rights on the
stadium.
Maybe we wouldn't. But, you know, that was clearly part of the strategy to compete with the Tribune.
What do you remember from when that deal went down? I mean, it seems a little bit legendary in my mind where Paul Tash just walked into the Tribune office and just said, "Hello, all, I bought you."
Yeah, and I got to say, it was amazingly well choreographed from the point of view of nobody knew. They really did keep it under wraps because, you know, the newsroom is pretty good at ferreting out any gossip. And it was no secret for years that that was our goal, to take over the Tribune or wait for the Tribune to disappear so we could better position ourselves. But yeah, that was very sudden. And I can say it was great news for the Tampa Bay Times when that happened.
Right.
But I honestly was personally found it to be a really, really sad day. I knew a lot of these people that worked at the Tribune, and they were really talented and committed and idealistic. These are people that work really hard, basically with the goal of making the world a better place. And I don't mean to be corny. And they do it for much less pay oftentimes than they could, given their skills. And Lord knows a community is better off when media outlets are competing.
Yep.
So I was very sad, but it was frankly good news for the Times.
We started a little news platform called The Catalyst. I think you've seen it. And I love being in the middle of everything. And I find it exhilarating, but I also at times find it exhausting because, you know, I didn't expect this pressure. You know, we'd come in with a mindset more like an Atlantic or a place that you would go for insight versus what I would call being a completist, where you'd say, this is where I get my news from, right? But then we, you know, we picked up a really solid, the best business writer, I think, in the area. And all of a sudden, everybody was coming and expecting all the news to be there. And we're like, okay, let's go with it. But from that sort of action flow, and I noticed last time you came in to the studio, I think you were looking for a podium to help one of your clients out at a talk, and there's a lot of energy there. So, I mean, are you pretty much just jacked up all the time on action and the flow of life?
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, one of the reasons I was at the Times for 27 years, which is a heck of a long time, and I was political editor for like 15 years. I've had some very prominent people in that job, mm-hmm. and most have done one election cycle.
Yeah.
And before they get exhausted or turn. So I left the Times mostly because I was just getting a little tired of doing the same thing. As great as politics are in Florida, there's still sort of a wash, rinse, repeat on a different election cycle every 2 years. But I was definitely concerned about, I mean, being a journalist and being political editor in a lot of ways is the greatest job in the world. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned about, am I going to be bored? from now on. And I got to say, you know, as a journalist, you finish the day and you go home and you say, well, this cool thing happened, that cool thing happened. It's not something that an insurance salesman right. is able to say, you know, not to slam insurance salesmen. And I got to say, my new job, first of all, I'm swamped with different stuff. And it's mostly very interesting stuff.
So pleasantly swamped.
Yeah.
You know, in that 15 years, heard on wash, rinse, and repeat, and definitely feel you there. Who are some of the standouts? Who are some of the people that you're glad you got a chance to cover and interact with?
Oh, tons, tons. I mean, I've done all the presidential race. I've met all the presidential candidates and presidents since 2004. Some closer than others. I met Trump a few times. Couldn't be more charming in person. People think he's whatever they think of him. Many people can't stand him, and many people think he's just terrible to the press. He couldn't be more charming and more solicitous of the media. And that was even well before he was running for president. There's no other state, I don't think, that has the politics that Florida has. And it's partly because there's so much unpredictable stuff that happens. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, in our own neck of the woods, we have Charlie Crist, who's a unique individual himself, personality-wise. And it's, you know, we come to take it for granted. This is a guy who is on the short list for Republican vice president, widely seen as a future president, who had astronomical approval ratings. Suddenly was basically cast out of his party, humiliatingly, when Marco Rubio was foolish enough to challenge him for the U.S. Senate. You know, Charlie went from a diehard chain gang Charlie Republican to a moderate independent to now, I would argue, a reasonably liberal Democrat. That's extraordinary. Rick Scott, I remember I was on a Marco Rubio campaign bus and somebody called me. I think we were the first people to report on Rick Scott. Somebody called me from Tennessee saying, hey, I've got this candidate. He's about to run for governor. This was when everybody assumed Bill McCollum, a fairly dull candidate, was going to be the Republican nominee. And so I want you to be aware of it. We're about to get going with a $1 million ad buy. And normally if somebody calls you and says, there's a guy running for governor that nobody's heard of, you kind of dismiss it as nothing. When they say there's going to be a $1 million ad buy, you take it serious. And I remember I turned to Marco Rubio and said, I think he was speaker then or former speaker. I said, speaker, do you know a guy named Rick Scott? I said, no, he said. And I said, well, he's about to announce for governor. He said, yeah, well, good luck. You know, so I think everybody in Florida, except maybe the out-of-state consultants working for Rick Scott, underestimated what a force he would be. Jeb Bush, I still think, was the most consequential governor we've had in decades and a long, long time. The guy just went into office wanting to do stuff and really disrupt the status quo. And he did. And as a reporter, he was one of those guys. You show up to his gaggle, which is when the press gathers around him to sort of throw questions at him. He could generate 5 news stories saying things. You show up to a gaggle for Charlie Crist or Rick Scott, there's no need almost. They never say anything. Rick Scott was all talking points. Charlie Crist was sort of pablum often, just sort of nice things. I think Rick DeSantis is more in the mode of Jeb Bush that way. He actually engages and answers questions directly.
And that brings me to a question. I've asked this question of some other guests, but when you talk about Trump, and this is in the spirit of the rinse, wash, and repeat or whatever, you know, when I think back of campaigns in the past, it's always been avoiding gotchas, right? So Mitt Romney had the 47% of people and something related to welfare and then deplorables with Hillary. And then Trump comes in and just says whatever he wants. And it just rolls. He just rolls. So do you think he's changed the way people feel they can talk now in political campaigns?
Well, I think because it was so ingrained into candidates, avoid the gotcha, don't say anything that's going to get you in trouble, that most of us just got tired of listening to these robots so cautious, not saying much or saying what sounded like BS talking points, that Trump tapped into a hunger for people to be actually authentic. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's happened to a lot of candidates now. So you've seen some candidates that sort of want to sort of adopt the Trump mode and be shocking. I think it's not just shocking. It's really not shocking. It's more just sound like a person that is a real person and not just a consultant-driven machine. So yeah, I'm not sure after Trump, that there's going to be a great appetite for people that are constantly generating controversy. But I do think there will always be an appetite for people that say what's on their mind or are not so careful. I think, you know, that's what happened with Hillary Clinton to a large extent.
So if you're putting your consulting hat on and you're advising a candidate on communicating, are you pushing them to be more authentic? And if they tell you it feels risky, what do you say to them?
You know, some candidates can do it and some candidates just can't. There are some candidates that are just so wary of the press that they, you know, want to rehearse everything that's said before they talk to the press or want to avoid the press. And there are a lot of candidates that just have that natural ability.
And do you feel like that's a valid fear with the press? One of the things I always get stuck on, it seems, I can't remember a time when we've been so collective, right? It's just the press, right? The press is thousands of individuals who have every kind of personality and every kind of motive, right? So I would assume in a group of 10 reporters, five are going to be standard, write it down, report it reporters. And there's going to be the other five maybe have agendas or whatever. So, you know, do they have a reason to be afraid of that? Is it just pretty much people there specifically to take their words and knife them with them?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think they do. I think there was a time, 40, 50 years ago, where you sort of had a select few boys on the bus that followed candidates around, and there was a lot of off the record. There was a lot of chatting. Nobody was jumping on every mildly stupid thing that a candidate said. That's not an ideal situation, but then that's turned into a much more democratic press where anybody with a video camera can be a reporter. And suddenly, I'm just thinking about running for president, there is a camera on them, everything they do. And they're just in a crowd of people saying hi. There's a camera and a boom mic around to catch anything they say. And so that's unfortunate.
Jordan Peterson, who is a Canadian professor slash intellectual and somewhat controversial, came to the Mahaffey a while ago. I like listening to him. I think he's very intelligent. And I was able to get backstage and spend some time with him. And I brought my phone and sat it down and just recorded our little conversation, let him know I'm going to have him do a quick interview. And I was with one of the other guys from the paper and we're like, let's get a couple pictures and autographs while we're at it. But I didn't turn off my phone. And after he sort of signed the first autograph, I noticed him look down. He reached down himself and hit the stop button on my recording. It's like, how aware does he have to be just, you know, hanging out with a couple guys or getting his, you know, getting a picture with him? He's actually thinking about stopping recording that phone. And it's just, that's a tough world to live in. You have to be that on guard all the time.
I have a friend who was interviewing a congressman who I won't name, but a prominent congressman in, this is not somebody from our neck of the woods, but, and he was interviewing him and then his phone rang. And he just had to take the call for some reason. He said, you know, please, you forgive me if I run outside and take it. The guy was fine. But he left his recorder going. And then he heard the congressman just totally flirting or more with his aide. And the aide was saying, do you want me to cut off this interview? And the guy was just like, oh, no, the press loves me. I can tell him any bullshit. And he didn't actually use that. I mean, because it was wouldn't have been fair.
So on the Catalyst, we love media, we love podcasts, we love recording video and audio, and we recently launched a new show called He Said, She Said with Peter Schorsch and his wife, Michelle. And so I'd love to hear, I'm sure you've interacted with him over the years, what's your take on him and some of the other local political figures?
You know, Peter is a really effective entrepreneur. I've not always been a fan, but he's, the website's fun, it's good. He has a business model. I don't know if these days he's calling himself a journalist or not. I don't think so. But, you know, he has a business model where basically the lobbying shops pay him on retainer and they can, you know, get what they want for their clients often on there. And that's a effective model. And that's a model we're seeing more and more. Politico Florida is largely subsidized by lobbying shops and political professionals in Tallahassee. I don't think clients can get necessarily what they want on there, but Peter has really been cutting edge in that way.
Yeah, my first interaction with him and I didn't really know him or I knew St. Peter's blog, and I was at a chamber event with Jack Latvala, and he was giving a talk, and it started at 7:30 in the morning, or I think we actually started talking at 8, and about 8:10, somebody kind of walked in and sat down, and about 8:15, somebody kind of came in a little bit late and sat down. Like 8:30, someone walked in, and the whole place just stopped. It was one of those four-tiered classrooms. And Latvala stopped talking mid-sentence. And the guy walked up to the fourth tier and sat down. And Latvala kind of sort of nervously said, well, I guess I'm glad I said everything controversial. And the guy goes, this is kind of one of those royal things. You may continue, you know, with the waved his arms and stuff. I'm like, wow. And then he said a couple more things and somebody asked him a somewhat tricky question. He goes, oh, I don't know if I want to answer that now. And the guy says, off the record, right? And then at the end, the aide cut him off. He's like, hey, sorry, we have another event we have to get to or, you know, something. And as he was walking out, he actually stopped and walked. This is Senator Latvala, walked all the way up four tiers to shake this guy's hand. They took a selfie, turned around and left. And I'm like, I leaned over next to me. I'm like, who is that guy, right? That just is commanding the room like that. And it was Peter Schorsch. And I was like, wow. So, you know, after kind of looking into what he did and how he filled was sort of a void in a certain kind of voice and presence. And I was completely, you know, I had no idea about pay for play or anything like that. At that point, I just, you know, people are paying attention to him. And he was somewhat of an inspiration. I thought, well, if he does that in the politics space, then I'd love to do that in the business space. And you know, it's a different animal. Nobody's paying for playing and really in the business space in that way, at least.
I would say Jack Latvala did not need to worry about Peter because Jack Latvala paid Peter a lot of money over the years and Peter was definitely his guy. But yeah, I think one of the reasons, and I'm trying not to be critical here, but one of the reasons Peter has made a lot of money and gotten clients from politicians is because it's an insurance policy.
Right.
He's got an influential site that everybody in Tallahassee reads. And if he starts really hammering a person, that can be really damaging. And so you're better off paying something to help deflect from that point of view.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, the new podcast that he's doing is largely, there's a lot of non-political content too. I mean, you know, I think him interacting with Michelle, you get to see his insight and some of his humor. And
he's a smart guy.
Yeah. Somebody said somebody was the fire festival of Democratic politics. And I thought that was a great line. You know, I won't say the name of it was, but it, you know, it comes up with some pretty good stuff. But there is that space potentially available to you to come and develop your own. You've got a lot of wind behind you from having the times under your belt. And we'll just consider this an offer to do this for the Catalyst right now. But have you thought about developing your own personal brand that way and putting your voice out there in that way?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought about it. You know, I've got so much to do and already a bunch of clients. But yeah, that's an interesting thought. I think I wouldn't be interested in doing it. I haven't heard that podcast. I bet it's good. But I wouldn't be interested in doing the minutia of politics right anymore because I've just done that for too long.
I think there's a hunger for a lot of stuff outside of that though too.
Yeah.
I mean, who better than you to know what's missing out there, what would be fresh and interesting to people?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, think about it.
I will. I enjoyed it. I had a TV show for a while with Al Rochelle on Bay News 9. It was a whole lot of fun, very different. I learned a lot interview techniques doing TV versus print.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed our conversation. I appreciate you coming in. And we have Tiger Bay today, and I know you moderated an event not too long
ago. I will
be
there. That's an interesting topic.
Yeah, I'm moderating the panel today. So
oh, good. It'll
be fun. Maybe you can give me a couple of questions to ask him.
Yeah, well, good. I'm a fan of what you guys do. I think it's great.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Sure.
And we'll keep an eye out.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owners representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit ceag2.com. That's CEAG. The number 2.com. And thanks also again to OPEN, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Aresti speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.